Very good. Okay, good. So hello again, everyone. We shall continue where we left off yesterday. We were starting to look at the shorter discourse on the mass of suffering, and we're going to continue with that. Unless my co-teacher wants to continue. When I came here this morning, this fellow was sitting in my seat, so I'm not sure if that was a takeover or something. He's very quiet, so I think we're... Okay. All right. So let us carry on where we were yesterday. So we're looking at the idea or this cousin of the Buddha, Mahanama, and he comes to the Buddha and he says that he gets overwhelmed by these defilements of the mind, the lobha, dosa, moha, the greed, hatred, and delusion, or if you like, desires, ill will, and confusion is another way of translating these words. And he's wondering why, what is it that I haven't abandoned within that these defilements still occur in the mind? That's what he's asking the Buddha. And so we're going to see what the Buddha replies to this. And what the Buddha says, and he says, Mahanama, there is a quality that remains in you that makes you have such thoughts. For if you had given up that quality, you would not still be living at home and enjoying sensual pleasures. But because you haven't given up that quality, you're still living at home and enjoying sensual pleasures. So what is that quality? Sensual pleasures give little gratification and much suffering and distress, and they're all the more full of drawbacks. Even though a noble disciple has clearly seen this with right wisdom, so long as they don't achieve the rapture and bliss that are apart from sensual pleasures and unskillful qualities, or something even more peaceful than that, they might still return to sensual pleasures. But when they have, when they do achieve the rapture and bliss, or something more peaceful than that, they will not return to sensual pleasures. So what he is saying here is that when you, the rapture and bliss here, this is apart from sensual pleasure, this is the rapture and bliss of samadhi, specifically the jhana states. And when you achieve that, then your interest in the sensory world is basically abandoned because you found something preferable. So you're no longer interested in that. But before you get there, before you have attained a deep sense of samadhi, you can be sure that you will still have an interest in the five sense world. And the reason is simply that we need some sort of happiness in our lives. We need something to kind of make life meaningful. And if you don't find happiness in one place, you're going to look for it somewhere else. And if you don't find it in the more profound aspects of the Dhamma, you're going to find it instead in the more ordinary parts of life. Yeah, the kind of the more obvious places. So this is the reason, and it doesn't matter if you are a noble person, it doesn't matter if you have understood the danger in the five senses, the drive for happiness, the drive for some kind of pleasure is so strong that you will still go for it unless you have the deep meditations. So this is one of the reasons why profound meditation is so important, because it allows us to let go of the five sense world. As long as we don't get that, we're still attached to some extent to the five sense world. And as long as you are attached to that five sense world, your mind is going to be biased to some extent, is going to be holding on to those things. And that bias is going to make it difficult, in fact impossible, to gain real insight into the mind and anything that you want to gain insight into. Because the biases of the mind are precisely the things that make insight impossible. You need that evenness of the mind, then it becomes possible. Having said that, the Buddha then goes on and he says, before my awakening, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, I too clearly saw with right wisdom that sensual pleasures give little gratification and much suffering and distress, and they're all the more full of drawbacks. But so long as I didn't achieve the rapture and bliss that are apart from sensual pleasures and unskillful qualities, or something even more peaceful than that, I didn't announce that I would not return to sensual pleasures. But when I did achieve that rapture and bliss or something more peaceful than that, I announced that I would not return to sensual pleasures. Again, just briefly, the something more peaceful than that is usually considered things like the fourth jhana. The fourth jhana is beyond rapture and bliss, or it could also be a reference to the immaterial attainments that are beyond the jhanas even. So once you have something better, then you can give up the sensual pleasures. Otherwise, you can't give it up. That's essentially what he's saying here. So even the Buddha-to-be, until he achieved the jhanas, and we shall see later on, towards the end of this course, how even the Buddha-to-be was struggling to achieve the jhana states, how he had to investigate the hindrances in the mind, the so-called upakilesas, and how by investigating that and overcoming those, that's how he was able to achieve jhanas and then awakening down the track. So these are very profound things. Even the Buddha is struggling to achieve these things. And this is, I think, a very important point. It's so easy to underestimate the depths of these things, so easy to think that, yeah, I have attained the jhanas, you get some bliss and happiness. But clearly, if the Buddha-to-be was having trouble achieving these things, it means that they are extremely profound. It is not just bliss and happiness of an ordinary kind. It is not just a little bit of bliss and happiness, but it is an otherworldly kind of bliss and happiness. You're stepping out of the ordinary world and achieving something really profound. And these are the things that give us a hint as to what these things actually mean. And we don't underestimate what these things are about. So now the Buddha is going to talk about the sensual pleasure of the five senses. He's going to talk about the upside and the downside. And so this is kind of the, again, it's just to try to kind of move towards a right view about these things, so we can abandon them and we can move beyond them. And he says, what is the gratification of sensual pleasures? There are these five kinds of sensual stimulation. What five? Sights known by the eye that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing. Sounds known by the ear that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing. Smells known by the nose that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing. Tastes known by the tongue that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing. Touches known by the body that are likable, desirable, agreeable, pleasant, sensual, and arousing. These are the five kinds of sensual stimulation. The pleasure and happiness that arise from these five kinds of sensual stimulation, this is the gratification of sensual pleasures. So this gives an idea what sensual pleasure means in the suttas. It is anything that comes in through the five senses that you like. That's basically what it is. And that's a lot. Yeah, it is kind of almost everything in our life revolves around the seeking of pleasures in the five senses. Certainly avoiding the suffering. So it is a lot, from small little things, just like feeling comfortable or enjoying a nice drink. That reminds me, enjoying a nice drink. Yeah, forgot about that. See, this is kind of an advantage of... No, I shouldn't be so frivolous. I was going to say the advantage of reading the suttas, but that's a terrible thing to say. This is just perfect for my throat, actually, so this is great. This was just given to me when I came in, and I always try to accept the kindness of people when they offer me something. So this is just right, so great. So that's kind of obvious, and we know what that means. And in our lives, we're always seeking for these things, sights that are agreeable. Like being at Jhana Grove in nature here, and etc., etc. But there is also an important point to be made that this the pleasantness or the likability of the five senses, it comes in various kind of degrees. And there are aspects of the five senses that actually are useful because they make you more calm. They incline you towards meditation, they incline you towards a peaceful mind. And then there are aspects of the five senses that have the opposite effect, that are very exciting, that lead to all kind of craving and all kind of problems. So one of the things to understand is that when we're dealing with the world of the five senses, there are some aspects of that that are okay and that we can use and actually incline us in the right way. And then there are other aspects of the five senses that are very problematic and which we should actually need to get away from. So to give an example, when you come here to Jhana Grove and you enjoy the beautiful environment and the nature around you, see the kangaroos jumping around or whatever it is, it's kind of, it's peaceful. Yeah, it is still the five senses, but it's peaceful. It leans the mind in the right direction. So kind of being in nature is not a problem. Or when you come here, even though we are a large group of people together, it's a good company. There are good people here. There's a feeling of... it's a good vibe, yeah, in this room when people are coming together in this way. I don't know if you heard, I learned this new word when I was in California recently, and they said, vibe is out, juju is in. So the juju is good in this hall. This is kind of the latest word. And everyone over 40 had no idea what I was talking about. Everyone under 40 then knew exactly what juju meant. It was kind of fascinating. So from then on, I went around. I said juju everywhere when I was wandering around in the U.S. So the feeling is good. And sometimes we need to use that... the five senses in a good way and avoid those aspects of the five senses that are too exciting, too stimulating, that lead to lots of craving and agitation of the mind. And it's not that hard to make that distinction. Same thing if you're listening to something. You can listen to some peaceful Buddhist chanting. You can maybe even listen to some peaceful music. And you can listen to music that is very... agitating, very kind of almost violent, some of the music that people listen to. And then you can see what actually helps you to lean in the right direction and what in the wrong direction. Food, there's the way we deal with food on a retreat like this. Please enjoy your food. It's okay to enjoy your food. That is not a problem. As long as you use the food in a good way. The problem arises if you think about food in the afternoon or the evening. That is where the problem arises. And I don't know if you do that. Maybe some of you do because you're used to having an evening meal. But you get used to it very quickly. And then you don't really think about it anymore. And that is okay. That is the right way of using food. You don't indulge, but you enjoy it when it's there. So it's very important to find the right balance in the five sense world. Not to kind of reject everything out of hand, but moving in the right direction. So we don't go too far. We don't have a life that is completely joyless or stupid or whatever, because that doesn't make any sense either. So that is the gratification of sensual pleasures. And now, guess what? We're going to look at the drawbacks in sensual pleasures. So this is kind of what Buddhism is famous for, looking at the downside of things, the suffering of things. But of course, again, the point is that what we are trying to do is actually achieving a higher happiness. That's always important to have that at the back of your mind. What is the drawback of sensual pleasures? It's when a gentleman, or gentle person, maybe we should say, earns a living by means such as computing, accounting, calculating, farming, trade, raising cattle, archery, government service, or one or other of the professions. But they must face cold and heat, being hurt by the touch of flies, mosquitoes, wind, sun, and reptiles, and risking death from hunger and thirst. This is the drawback of sensual pleasures apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. Now, perhaps you think this doesn't sound like much, but actually, even this is quite bad. Yeah, the fact that we are alive, the fact that there are certain things that we have to do, you have to work or whatever, it means that we are always faced with these things. And this was obviously much worse at the time of the Buddha, because they didn't have aircon and they didn't have all these kind of things to make life more comfortable. But even today, it is impossible to get things always right. Yeah, sometimes you come into the hall and it's too cold, and then in the late afternoon it gets too hot. Yeah, very hard to find the balance of these things. Or you have a mosquito buzzing in your room, or you walk through the forest and you come across snakes. I don't know, not too many snakes this time of the year, it's too cold, but sometimes you come across snakes in the forest, or whatever it is. Life is always a little bit, life is never exactly right. And this is one of the things that you start to understand when meditation starts to work, is that the body disappears. And when the body disappears, so many of the aches and displeasures and things in life also disappear with the body. The body is an endless source of discomfort, an endless source of problems. And that is what you start to understand when meditation really works. I think there's somewhere in the suttas where the Buddha says something to the effect that the body is like an abyss of painful feelings or something like that. It's kind of this unending, kind of source of painful feelings. And sometimes it's hard to see because we're so used to it. And when you start to withdraw and you start to go into deeper meditation, they start to understand what actually the problem is. It really is quite a serious problem. And you need to contrast sometimes to understand this. Yes, this is already a problem. We are faced with these things at all times. We cannot really avoid it. Things are never really quite right. So, hunger and thirst, right? And all of these things. Risking death from hunger and thirst. I don't know, but that's kind of pretty rare these days. But at least hunger and thirst are problems and realities. Okay, then it goes on, that a gentle person might try hard, strive, and make an effort, but fail to earn any money. If this happens, they sorrow and wail and lament, beating their breast and falling into confusion, saying, "Oh, my hard work is wasted, my efforts are fruitless." This too is a drawback of sensual pleasures, apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. Yeah, you work really hard and things fail. It doesn't work out the way you thought it would work out. Yeah, things are kind of, you spend so much time trying to get hold of becoming wealthy or making a living for yourself, and it doesn't turn out the way you expect it. And life is very often like that. You start out in life and you kind of look to the future. You have a dream about what your life is going to be like. And in that dream, you're always very successful and things become great and wonderful. And you are this marvelous entrepreneur building up a company and something. But the reality, of course, is often very different. Things don't work out the way we want them to work out. And the reason is because the world is so complex. There's so many things working in the world. There's no guarantee that what we do will work out. And this is difficult. Yeah, you work hard and your boss doesn't see you. The boss sees someone else who's a real scallywag instead. You know that feeling? Yeah, this is kind of how what life is like sometimes. Then you feel really disappointed. And the life doesn't work out. And then what happens? And then you die. And you spent your life working really hard, trying to kind of make money, and then doesn't work out, and then you die at the end of it all. What a waste. Yeah, what a terrible thing. Searching for something that could not be guaranteed. And then at the end of it all, you just disappear and nothing really happened. And of course, the answer to that is that instead of being so focused on things that are so uncertain and so unreliable, that you never know whether it's going to happen, whether that dream is going to be fulfilled or not. Actually, guaranteed the dream isn't going to be fulfilled. It may be a little bit fulfilled. But instead of doing that, which is so uncertain, you come back to those things you can do something about. And that is living the spiritual life, living with kindness, living with care, living with compassion. That is what we can do something about, living with generosity. Some people are incredibly generous, just in the way they live their life and always helping out. I was looking at one of the Anagarikas at Bodhinyana Monastery. He's one of these people who was just really into service and helping people all the time, continuously. And I was just so impressed watching this Anagarika. I thought, wow, you know, I wish I understood that when I was an Anagarika 30 years ago, whatever it is now. And this is beautiful conduct. Yeah, I was supporting everyone, supporting the monks, of course, but also supporting the lay people when they come in, helping them bring in the dishes and sorting things out. It's like this continuous act of service, making your life into an act of service. Very beautiful when you see that, and doing it with a smile, always with a smile, never begrudging anything, right? Understanding the power of service. And this is then how you learn to live your life instead, because this is what we can do. This is what actually is possible. Whereas what happens in the world is always going to be unreliable, uncertain. And you're going to end up beating your breast and wailing. I like this idea of beating your breast. This is kind of a nice way of grieving and lamenting. Oh no, beating your breast and falling into confusion. Don't fall into confusion. Instead, be clear and bright by practicing the spiritual path. Okay, let's carry on. That gentle person might try hard, strive and make an effort, and succeed in earning money. But they experience pain and sadness when they try to protect it, thinking, how can I prevent my wealth from being taken by the rulers or bandits, consumed by fire, swept away by flood, and taken by unloved heirs? And even though they protect and ward it, rulers do take it, bandits do take it, fire does consume it, the floods do sweep it away, and the unloved heirs do take it. They sorrow and wail and lament, beating their breast and falling into confusion. What used to be mine is gone. This too is a drawback of sensual pleasures apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. Even when you do succeed, because when you succeed, you become, you own these things. That's what you think anyway. Of course, you're wrong about that. That's what you think. Yeah, you have succeeded. Now this is mine. This is my wealth. You become really attached to it. And the reason you become attached to it is because you work so incredibly hard to achieve it. And so it's like your whole life is invested in these things. And that's why it becomes so important to you. And if you lose it, it means that your entire life's investment is in vain and it's stupid. So of course you will hold on to those things. And it's kind of one of those strange things. The more you have in the world, the more often, the more attached you are to those things. Even though you have way more than you actually need or require. Why? Well, because that's the way the human mind works, I suppose. So you try to protect it, but of course there's no way, there's no guarantee that you will be able to protect things. You never know what's going to happen next. You never know what's going to happen with the economy. You don't know if the banks are going to go bust, the stock market is going to go down. You don't know if a fire is going to destroy your house. All of these things are so uncertain. And that uncertainty is a problem. And because of that, you're anxious, you're fearful, you try to protect, and despite your best effort at trying to protect, there is no guarantee that you will succeed. There's always an underlying anxiety there, underlying problem. So this is kind of the issue here. There's the problems with that sensory realm, because it is external to us, because we share that realm with the world, we cannot control it, and this is precisely the problem. Furthermore, for the sake of sensual pleasures, kings fight with kings, aristocrats fight with aristocrats, Brahmins fight with Brahmins, householders fight with householders, mother fights with her child, a child with a mother, father with child with father, brother fights with brother with sister with brother. And I guess we could add sister with sister as well, just to kind of complete it. And friends fight with friend. And once they've started quarreling, arguing and disputing, they attack each other with fists, stones, rods and swords, resulting in death and deadly pain, or death-like suffering. This too is a drawback of sensual pleasures apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. So much of the fighting in the world happens because of the five sense realm. So much of the violence, so much of the arguments, so much of the conflicts that we have, as we have seen before, is based on this. And even the people who are the most dear to each other, even those people who are the closest in your life, like family members and whatever, still you fight with each other. You fight because of these things. That's how important they are. And we are not really able to overcome this as long as we are attached to that five sense realm, as long as that is important to us. We get led astray. We're not able to really practice according to morality or according to the spiritual life, because these things are so deeply ingrained in us. The bias is so strong, and that we are kind of taken away from the spiritual path. So it's kind of amazing. Yeah, it happens to all of us. And you may think that you are practicing well in this life and you don't really argue with people anymore. And lots of people I know in the monastery, it's a remarkably peaceful place. It is very, very rare to see a monk argue with another monk. Can't remember when it last happened. Very, very rare. It tends to be a harmonious place. But the underlying problem is still there. It doesn't take much of a shift or much of something to happen before these things emerge again. So just because you are successful now, a little bit of reconditioning, a little bit of circumstances being different, and these things re-emerge. And this is kind of the problem. And so you want to get rid of this once and for all, because otherwise it is there, under the surface, waiting to come out. Okay, furthermore, for the sake of sensual pleasures, they don their sword and shield, fasten the bow and arrows, and plunge into battle massed on both sides, with arrows and spears flying and swords flashing. There they are struck with arrows and spears, their heads are chopped off, resulting in death and death-like suffering. This too is a drawback of sensual pleasures apparent in this very life, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. I like the understatement. Having your head chopped off is a drawback. It's kind of, yes, it is a drawback, quite right. Sometimes it's kind of interesting when you see this. But it's true, All this violence, it so often it comes down to the five sense realm. In the realm of samadhi, in the realm of the jhanas, there is none of this. It's only in the five sense realm you find this. It is caused by that five sense realm, ultimately. And then we come to the final one, and this is a little bit different, as you will see. Furthermore, for the sake of sensual pleasures, they conduct themselves badly by way of body, speech, and mind. When their body breaks up after death, they are reborn in the place of loss, a bad place, the underworld, and hell. This is a drawback of sensual pleasures to do with lives to come, a mass of suffering caused by sensual pleasures. And of course, this one is the biggest one of all, is the idea that you don't know where you're going to get reborn. And if you end up doing many bad things by way of body, speech, and mind, then the result is precisely that you get reborn in a bad place in the future. And that is really suffering. That is really terrible. And this is kind of one of the scary things about Buddhism, this potential for a bad rebirth in the future. And remember that when we are too attached to the sensory world, too attached to those things, we do often end up doing bad things, because these things are so important to us. We have this powerful vested interest. We think that life is about this. This is what life is all about, these sensual objects of the world. And because this is what life is about, we're willing to do bad things in the pursuit of success in that five sense realm. If someone tries to take away your partner in life, if your partner is kind of pursued by someone else or whatever it is, then the crimes of passion is one of the kind of big things in the world. because you are so attached to that partner, that person is so important to you. You are willing to go very, very far to protect that relationship with that person, even to the point of killing, even to the point of really doing some terrible things in life. This is the power of the five sense world. It holds over our minds because it appears that this is the meaning of life, the success in that five sense realm. It's because our view of the world is so limited. We see this one tiny little life. Then this in this life, all we really have is the five sense world. And that's why it matters so enormously to us. But because that is all we see here, all our actions tend to be based on that bias that this life is so important. And then you realize the idea of rebirth, and you start to see, actually, it is so large. The reality of life, the reality of existence is this enormous thing. It carries on potentially endlessly into the future. And when you see that larger view of things, you start to see that actually what I do in this life, because it matters for this larger view, actually, I have to be very careful how I live this life. It is not just about this life. It actually affects everything. And then you start to understand that it's crazy to be so attached to the five-sense world. It is crazy to act on this world in a way that has a negative effect on this much bigger picture, this much larger idea of what existence really is about. The thing that we have in this world only are only here for a very short time. And if you place all your everything you do and all your interests are really focused on this particular life, and then when you come to the end of your life, you're going to say, I wasted my chance. I've only built up things for this particular existence. I have done things that are good for this life. Built up lots of status and possessions and acquaintances and all of these kind of things. But now I have to leave everything behind. There's nothing to take with me. I wasted the opportunity. I could have built up something far more important that will also be a support for future lives. But I didn't take the opportunity. And you can imagine coming to your deathbed and dying with that feeling. It's not very nice. You're kind of, it's difficult to find peace when everything that you have worked so hard for has to go. And very often, as it says here, not only have you worked really hard for these things, but in the pursuit of these things, you have done bad things. Because this is what mattered to you, because this is what life was about. This was so important. You did bad things in the pursuit of the things in the five-sense world. And then there's a double whammy. Not only do you have to give up everything that you have built up, but you also have the heartache. You have the remorse, the regret of having done bad things, knowing that this will affect your future. That is terrible. Please don't make that mistake. Because if you make that mistake, it's kind of, you come to your deathbed and you will feel really confused and really terrible. That is not a good way to die. And it doesn't matter, you know, what you, there's no one really to help you at that point. You are there by yourself on your deathbed. It becomes a very lonely and kind of scary journey if you live in the wrong way. So this is how you think about this. Remember, understand this life in perspective. When you understand this life in perspective, then you start to think differently about this life. Start to think differently about what really matters, what is really important in the world. And this is why that book that I mentioned before about the near-death experiences can be so useful, because it actually helps you to engage with the idea of a broader vision of what reality and life is all about. And when you engage with that and you start to feel these things, it becomes visceral, then it becomes something you can use in this kind of context to live better and give up some of your attachments to the things of this life. This is what this. This is then the one that is about future existence, whereas all the other ones are the danger of sensual pleasures in this life. This is the danger of sensual pleasures in with lives to come, about future existence. There is a nice simile. Maybe I can talk about that simile. Just mention that simile now. There's a nice simile again from the famous Portalia Sutta that I mentioned many times already, Majjhimanikaya 54. This is a simile of, again, all to do with sensual pleasures and their downside and all of these kind of things. And in this simile, the simile is of a man. A man, he kind of comes from a village or something, and he enters a forest. And he has an axe with him when he enters. No, he does not have an axe. He has a bag with him when he enters this forest. That's right, just a bag. The second one has the axe. Okay, let me get this right. And of course, the forest here is like a simile for the sensual realm, right? This forest, because it is kind of dense, you can't see very far. Your mind is limited by the five senses. It is kind of you're kind of encumbered by these five senses. According to the Dhamma, the way that the mind is kind of expansive is when you give up the five senses and you develop samadhi, you get a limitless mind. But the mind that is trapped in the five senses is very limited and encumbered by this. You can't see very far. You don't really see the horizon. There's no sense of perspective in what is going on because you are held by the five senses. And so he enters this jungle, or this forest or whatever, and he wanders around. And of course, when you wander around in the five-sense realm, you're looking for gratification, you're looking for satisfaction, you're looking for the pleasures in that realm. So he's wandering around, looking around, checking out the trees, right? And then he comes to a mango tree here, or a tree with fruit, whatever kind of fruit it is. Let's say it's a mango tree here. And then he's really excited because he found some nice sensual pleasures in the five-sense realm. So he climbs that mango tree, gets up to all the nice mangoes, and then he starts eating the mangoes, right? And we all know what a really nice mango is like, at least for me. When I get a really nice mango, I think, wow, this is really nice, this mango, really sweet, just ripe, just the right texture. Not all mangoes are like that, but when you get the right one, the kind of the best one, and these are the best ones. And if you don't like mangoes, think of something else. And then you start eating, and what does it feel like? Well, it's like an intoxication, right? You get intoxicated by the world of the five senses, and really nice food like that can also be intoxicating in a certain way. You lose your mindfulness, and all you are aware of is the delight of mangoes. That is, your mind is filled with the delight of mangoes. And then as you are there, kind of enjoying yourself, indulging, getting intoxicated by the five-sense realm. This is an important point, that in Buddhism, intoxication is not just drinking alcohol. Sure, drinking alcohol, you get intoxicated, but there are many, many ways of getting intoxicated. One of them is the enjoyment of the five-sense realm. We all know what that can feel like. You can lose your mindfulness. You can get completely lost in that realm, especially when the desires are very strong. And we saw before, we can get intoxicated by feeling young. We looked at the idea at the very beginning of contemplating old age and sickness. You are young and strong, you get intoxicated by that. You are healthy and well, you get intoxicated by that. All of these things are intoxicating because they turn us away from the reality, turn us away from seeing things as they actually are. That's why they are intoxicating. The mind gets biased. It has a vested interest, and it doesn't see things in the right way anymore. And one of those intoxications is eating mangoes in the top of a tree. That's one of those famous intoxications. So he's up there eating mangoes, and then he starts filling his bag with more mangoes. Getting really greedy because the mangoes are so nice. And as he is sitting up there, this other fellow comes along, and this is the fellow carrying an axe. And he comes to the bottom of that tree, and he sees, wow, lots of mangoes. He doesn't see the fellow in the top, he just sees all the mangoes. And he thinks, well, I don't know how to climb a tree, so I've just got to chop it off at the root, and then I will eat all the mangoes. So he starts chopping the tree down, and this other fellow is in the top. What happens is that if that fellow in the top doesn't come down from that tree very quickly, he's going to be in serious trouble. When the tree falls over, he might die, or he certainly would injure himself really, really badly. This is the thing. The idea here is the idea that when you are indulging, you are intoxicated, you stop seeing the problems around you. You no longer have yoniso manasikara. You no longer have that wise attention where you look at the dangers in the world. You forget about the dangers because you are so absorbed in the intoxicating indulgence in the five-sense realm. And so this is the danger, right? And so instead of being intoxicated by these things, we are alert. We see the dangers, and we understand what is the right way forward. And we probably don't even climb that tree in the first place. Instead, we climb the mountain. Someone said to me that they wanted to hear the simile of the mountain. So this is kind of nice. So people tell me what they want to hear. They say, oh, please do this sutta, please give this simile. And that's kind of nice. And so the alternative is actually to climb the mountain instead. Instead of kind of being intoxicated in that tree. And in the suttas, the idea of climbing a mountain is like attaining samadhi, attaining the jhana states. And you climb the mountaintop, and when you get to the mountaintop, you get this fabulous view. You see the landscape around you. You see the fields, the villages, the roads, the little rivers all around. And in the simile, there's two friends coming to the foot of a mountain. And one friend says to the one, oh, let's climb the mountain. And the other friend says, nah, I couldn't be bothered climbing the mountain. Yeah, you just go. And so the one fellow, he goes to the top of the mountain. And he looks out and he sees all of these things all the way around. And he shouts down to his friend at the bottom, come up. Yeah, you won't believe it, what you can see from the top of the mountain. You get this bird's eye view. You can see all of these things. And the fellow at the bottom says, nah, I don't believe a word of what you say. What kind of friend is that, right? Anyway, so this guy on the top, he gets really exasperated. This is like the Buddha on top of the mountain. Yeah, he gets a bit exasperated. I don't think the Buddha gets exasperated, but anyway, something like that. So he goes down to the bottom of the mountain. He grabs his friend by the arm, pulls him up to the top and says, look, right? What do you see? Oh, yeah, you're right. I see fields, I see roads, I see rivers. But just now we heard you saying that it's not nonsense, that there aren't any fields or rivers. So what are you talking about? It's because I was blocked by this mountain. I couldn't see those things. That's kind of his excuse. So this is kind of the point. Yeah, we are blocked in ordinary life. We are blocked by the five sense world. We are blocked by the five hindrances. We have no idea what's going on. And then one day we decide to climb the mountain. This is what we're doing here at Janagro. We're climbing that mountain. This is kind of the point of being here. And climbing the mountain is actually achieving samadhi, achieving some peace in your meditation. That is the climbing of the mountain. You are emerging from the five-sense realm, elevating yourself above that five-sense realm. And only when you get to the top of that mountain can you really understand what the five-sense realm is about. You need to come out of it. You need to drop the indulgence, the vested interest, all of those problems. And only when that five-sense realm is completely gone can you understand what it is about. That is the idea of the bird's eye view. Because only when something is completely gone, it is the absence of things that makes you understand things. You cannot understand things by the presence, but only fully by the absence. It's that famous simile of the tadpole and the water. As long as the tadpole is in the water, it cannot understand water because it's always had water around it. How can you understand something when it's always been there? There is no comparison. There is no perspective. But when the tadpole becomes a frog, jumps out of the water, now it can understand because now it has an alternative viewpoint. It has a perspective on things. And this is such an important thing, and it has very profound consequences for the whole idea of meditation. Very often we get told on the meditation retreats that when you have pain in the body and all of these kind of things, you're told to watch the pain. But actually, it is usually a waste of time to watch the pain in meditation. I hate to say this because some people spend their lifetime watching pain and they kind of feel a bit cheated. If you tell them it's a waste of time. It's a waste of time because you cannot really properly understand pain by watching it. You can understand it a little bit, but not very much. The way to really understand pain is to emerge from that pain completely, understanding the bliss of the mind, understanding the happiness of the mind. And when the pain is gone, precisely because it is gone, precisely because it has ceased, it has nirodha. Nirodha is the Pali word for cessation. That is when you can understand it because you have emerged from it. Things are understood by emerging from them, not by being with them. And so much of the idea of being with things and understanding things by their presence is not very useful. That's why the deeper your meditation is, the more you withdraw from the ordinary world, the more ability you have to understand that world, because the world is ceasing, is coming to an end. You get the proper perspective. That is where insight is possible. The deeper your samadhi, the more power your insight will have, precisely because things have come to a stop, come to a halt. Anyway, so that is then the danger of conducting yourself badly by body, yeah, and you do these things because you are intoxicated and you don't really understand, you have forgotten the big picture of things, and because of that you end up doing many bad things, and you come to regret it bitterly when you come to the end of your life, and that is what this is about. So there you are. This is the danger and the drawbacks in sensual pleasures and the five sense realm. And as you can see, it is actually fairly straightforward. There's nothing here that is really kind of weird or strange. It's kind of the ordinary things of life. But very often we don't really properly reflect on the ordinary things of life. We don't really see it properly because, again, we have a vested interest in that world. And so we're not really capable of seeing the downsides. Sometimes you need to remember these things. And by remembering them and actually contemplating them, that is when you start to understand what is really going on. So much of the trouble in the world are caused precisely by this. So there you are. This is, again, some of the reflection on the problems of the five sense world and why it is that we want to do meditation practice in Buddhism, because it allows us to emerge a little bit from that world. Okay. So now let us move on a little bit. And now we're going to look at the main sutta here. Is a sutta called In the Middle. This is from the Numerical Discourses, the sixth chapter, sutta number 61. And it is a sutta that I have never really paid much attention to before until this person said, do this sutta. And I said, yes, ma'am, I'll do that sutta. Actually, she was very polite. She didn't say do this sutta at all. But she suggested the sutta. And as always, it's nice to have suggestions and it allows us to look at things in a slightly different way. So this particular sutta is based on a verse, and a verse that was spoken by the Buddha, and it was spoken in the Sutta Nipata, the Parayanavaga, which is the fifth chapter of the Sutta Nipata. It's a long conversation between a number of Brahmins and the Buddha, and it's a very profound and very deep kind of conversation, and a lot of the verses there are quite enigmatic. They're hard to really understand what is going on. And so this particular sutta we're going to look at now is an explanation of the one of these very enigmatic verses to draw out the meaning of what is going on. And sometimes the answer is just as enigmatic as the original verse. And you have to draw out the meaning of the actual, of even the explanation to the verse. It is interesting. So, and one of the interesting things that we will see here as we go through this is that there's a group of monks coming together, and each monk has a different understanding of the verse, right? And then they go to the Buddha and they say to the Buddha, "Well, venerable sir, you know, we have all have different understandings. Which one of us is right?" And very interestingly, the Buddha says, "Well, each one of you is right in your own way." Which is fascinating. It shows us how it is possible to, especially with verse, which are inspirational in nature, it is possible often to interpret things in many ways, and the various ways can all be right if you're coming from the right understanding. But first of all, let's look at this verse. Let's look at the source of the verse, and then we will look at the explanations afterwards. This little sutta, these verses are called the Questions of Tissa Metteya, and found in the Sutta Nipata, the last chapter, the fifth chapter. This is sutta number 3. And so these are the questions that these Brahmins ask the Buddha, and then the Buddha replies. And the reason why this is interesting is because, of course, that these Brahmins, they came from the Brahmanical point of view, and they came from that culture in ancient India. So the way they ask questions is different from how we ask questions as Buddhists. So you get a bit of insight into that culture, the Brahmanical culture of that time, how they thought about the spiritual life. And then you get the Buddha coming from the Buddhist point of view and replying from a Buddhist point of view to these Brahmanical questions. So that's kind of fascinating, kind of interesting to see this interplay between the existing hegemonic religion at the time and then the Buddhism and the new understanding of the world that comes through the insight of the Buddha. So now we have this Brahmin called Tissa Metteya, and we'll see what he says. And this is what he says. He says, "Who here in the world is content?" said the Venerable Tissa Metteya. "Who has no disturbances? What thoughtful one, having known both ends, is not stuck in the middle? Who do they say is a great man? Who here has escaped the seamstress?" That's the question, right? You can see why it is a bit enigmatic. You wonder what on earth is going on here. And this is the Buddha's reply here. "Leading the spiritual life among sensual pleasures or among the five sense world," replied the Buddha, "rid of craving, ever mindful, a mendicant who, after assessing, is quenched, that's who has no disturbances. That thoughtful one, having known both ends, is not stuck in the middle. He is a great man, a great person, I declare. He has escaped the seamstress here." So you can see why this needs a little bit of explanation, because it is not at all obvious. But let's just very quickly just have a look at this verse before we go to the sutta that explains this. Who in the world is content? Of course, the idea of contentment is also very important in Buddhism. Finding the kind of the solution to the real, what we really want in life, is contentment that we're often seeking for, and yet we end up just running and running and running and never actually getting anywhere. So the understanding that contentment is a profound kind of happiness lies behind this. Who actually is really content in the world? Who are the sages that actually achieve this? Who has no disturbances? And the word for disturbance here is, for no disturbance is anenja, and nenja is a disturbance. And disturbance just means that the mind is not even, the mind is not kind of at ease or at peace. And in the Buddhist path, the real anenja is arrived at when you get to the fourth jhana. When you get to the fourth jhana state, the mind is really completely cool and is able to deal with any problems that may arise in life. That's why insight is really, ultimately, it's the fourth jhana is a perfect platform for insight, because the mind is no longer disturbable. It is perfectly even. So who has reached this state of being imperturbable? That's what he's asking. Where everything in the world, nothing in the world can touch you anymore. You're cool in all kinds of circumstances. This is kind of what lies behind some of these ideas here. And what thoughtful one, which thoughtful one? In other words, the person who is thoughtful, having known both ends, is not stuck in the middle. So this is where it gets very cryptic. What does this mean? Both ends. What are these ends? What is the middle? And this is what we will get back to in a second. But as a starting point, you might think perhaps that both ends might perhaps refer to the middle way. So the both ends is the Attakilamatana Yoga, the tormenting of the body, and the sensual indulgence. This is one possibility. And not stuck in the middle might be you're not stuck maybe on the path either. Like the famous simile of the raft. You use the raft for crossing the river or the water, but you don't carry it with you afterwards. So that is one possible explanation. As it turns out, this is not what is meant here, but that is kind of gives an idea what might be meant here. Who do they say is a great man, the Mahapurisa, who has escaped the seamstress? Seamstress, right? So what does this mean? Of course, the idea here of the seamstress is the kind of is an idea of here it means something that keeps existence going. It sews samsara together so that the samsaric perpetuation of life and death carries on, through being sewn together in this way. This is kind of the idea of the seamstress here. So we'll see what that seamstress is. And then the Buddha gives his answer, leading the spiritual life among the five senses, rid of craving, ever mindful. So this idea of rid of craving, that kind of gives us a good clue to what is going to happen next. A mendicant who, after assessing, in other words, after being wise and careful and all these kind of things, is quenched. Quenched is this nice word of nibbuto or nibbana, where everything kind of becomes stilled. The fire goes out. The thirst has been given up. It's the opposite of thirst, being quenched. That is the one who has no disturbances. And then he says, that thoughtful one, having known both ends. So we need to know the ends, and we need to be not stuck in the middle. This is the great person, I declare. He has escaped the seamstress here. So that is the background. And based on that background, we are going to look at what this actually means, and we're going to talk about this in, I think, a bit of detail. It is really just an expansion of the idea of right view. This is quite profound, and it's a little bit technical. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but just to kind of do something slightly different, I think it might be interesting to see this. But I'm going to stop there because time is already up. So once again, please enjoy a nice lunch together, and then we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock this afternoon.